Welcome to the Forency Podcast. Forency.us is a language training website for Hebrew, Arabic, and Russian designed specifically for intermediate to advanced learners. Our daily lessons prepare you to read real foreign language news articles and listen to actual foreign language media on a wide variety of subjects to put you on the path to language mastery. If you're studying Hebrew, Arabic, or Russian, you can visit our site at forency.us. That's foreignc.us. And enter the promo code Language Mastery for a 10% discount on our annual and 6-month subscriptions. Today I spoke with Dr. Jonas Siboni, who's a comparative Semitic linguistics expert, and I reached out to him after finding him on Twitter because he tweets out some really great stuff just comparing ancient Semitic words and showing their similarities and differences. So I reached out to him to see if he would be interested in coming on the podcast, which he was, and we decided to speak about blessings and curses in Judeo-Arabic languages of Maghrebi Jews, so Jews in North Africa. We did go into that, and we had a really great discussion about it, but we also spent the first half of the conversation just talking about Semitic languages in general, their evolution, the similarities between Hebrew, Aramaic, Arabic, and then we also got into what are Judeo-Arabic dialects, where were they spoken, how did they develop, and things of that sort. It was a really great conversation. He's a really knowledgeable guy. I hope you enjoy the show. So thanks for joining. I'm here today with Dr. Jonas Siboni, who's a professor of Hebrew at Strasbourg
University. Yeah, Strasbourg University.
So thanks again for joining.
Thank you very much. I'm deeply honored to be with you today, and I'd like to thank you for having me.
So for people who are wondering how I found you, I came across you on Twitter because you send out these really great tweets of Semitic language tweets, essentially, of Arabic or Aramaic or Hebrew, and you're showing the similarities between languages because you're an ancient Semitics or Semitic linguistics expert, correct?
Yeah, exactly.
So how did you get into that field?
I started to learn Hebrew and Arabic maybe 15 years ago. I was living in the south of France in the city of Montpellier. I started that when I was 20 years old, and a few years later, I went to Paris, to the National Institute of Oriental Languages, the French National Institute. I studied Hebrew, Arabic, North African Arabic, like Arabic dialects, and Jewish Arabic, Berber languages. So then I started to study all Semitic languages as well, and I did my PhD thesis about that a few years later, in 2003, I guess, 2013, sorry. So now I'm actually a linguist, and that's what I do. I just compare those Semitic languages.
What was it about Arabic and Hebrew that interested you? How come you chose those languages compared to other ones?
I heard those languages before, and I heard a little bit of Arabic in my family, but not that much, actually. Dialectal Arabic and modern Hebrew as well. And I started to get interested in those languages maybe when I did my bar mitzvah when I was 13 years old. Mm-hmm. I heard some more Hebrew and some Aramaic. And then, I don't know, I just wanted to find something to study. And I just got deeply on those languages. And I noticed the similarities, and it started to interest me a little bit more.
One thing people always ask me, and I'm not in a position to answer it, I kind of give a bastardized answer to it, but about the similarities between Arabic, Aramaic, and Hebrew, or the relationship between them. Because people always say, like, oh, well, if you study one, you know, can you understand the other one? And my answer is, well, no, but
no.
Once you know the languages, you can look at it and analytically break down, like, okay, well, these two things are the same, or these are related, and this is how it... But if you could just explain, you know, the evolution. I know it's a tough thing to ask you because you can go on forever on it, but
yeah,
you can explain the evolution of Hebrew, Aramaic, and Arabic and where they came from.
There are three different Semitic languages, so it's part of the same family, but maybe that Hebrew is something like 3,000 year old language, and Arabic maybe 2,500 years old. It's not that much of a difference, but it was not spoken on the same part of the, on the same group, undergroup of the Semitic languages. The thing is, that's exactly what you said. When you know how those languages are similar, you can understand the similarities. But if you just hear someone speaking Arabic or speaking Hebrew, you won't see that immediately. There's a question of pronunciation, which is very important to understand that problem. And maybe they split it something like 3,000 years ago. So it's just like when you speak French and you hear someone speaking Portuguese, you can understand that they have similarities, but there's no real mutual understanding between the two of them.
And would you say that biblical Hebrew is closer to classical Arabic than modern Hebrew?
Yeah, of course. The first thing is that classical Hebrew is the old variation of Hebrew, and classical Arabic as well. So the chronological gap is not as big as now. And there's maybe if you would try to speak classical Hebrew to someone speaking Arabic, you would understand it better than with modern Hebrew because of the pronunciation too.
Right.
The grammar is more similar as well. Sure.
And I always found that when I'm looking at it and I'm trying to see similarities, it seems that a lot of the words that are universals that are very ancient, you know, there's always going to be a word for gate or, you know, door, things of that nature that you'll be able to find similarities in that still carry over today. Is that correct?
Like more than with other words, that's what I mean. Like universal stuff. That's the question. Is it more gonna be similar in those languages?
Right, like food and eating and the roots of those.
Yeah, sure. The very concrete stuff. The things that you find real is the same, like real the same words in all Semitic languages are, for example, the family names like father, mother, or the body parts. Mm-hmm. Those stuff don't really move. But of course, if it's more of an abstraction, it's going to be a little bit different. If the meaning of a word is something that moved inside of a language, of course, it won't be the same in the two languages. Maybe I can find some examples of words. You can understand that it's connected, even if it's not really the same one. For example, one of the tweets that I did a few days ago was about the old Semitic word lahm. Lahm is food. Actually, in Hebrew it's bread, lehem, and in Arabic it's meat. So of course, when you see the two words, you understand that it's connected. But if it's in the middle of a sentence, people won't hear it because it's too much to identify.
And what was the root language that it came from initially?
That's a tough question, actually, because the question is, when do we start to say that it's Semitic? Mm-hmm. I don't know if I made myself clear.
Right. What do you think, if you had to hypothesize?
We think, actually, that there was a big group of languages that we call Kamito-Semitic or Afro-Asiatic languages. And one of those languages that you can cut into five parts, Berber languages, Egyptian, and Semitic languages, three of them. Those Semitic languages were maybe spoken 5 or 6,000 years ago. We don't know exactly where. Maybe it was in Egypt, Ethiopia, the Palestine region. We don't really know exactly, but all the Semitic languages have a common point, a common base. Mm-hmm. That's what we know. So yeah, maybe it was a group of people speaking one of those languages. Maybe it was already like a few dialects, and they moved from somewhere and they arrived to the Middle East. Like the first one were the Akkadians, and then other peoples. The Hebrew are maybe one of them, and the Arabs are one of the last that appeared in that history.
And if you could touch on, tell me a little bit about Aramaic. When did that become the lingua franca of the region, and where did that originate from?
Aramaic is like Akkadian, like Hebrew, like Arabic. That means that it's a group of people that moved to Middle East, the Arameans, that they arrived to Middle East maybe in the 12th century before our era, before our common era, and they established in the Middle East. And a few centuries later, maybe, I don't remember exactly, I think it's the Persians that made Aramaic a lingua franca, maybe 6th or 5th century before Christ. And then it became one of the most important spoken language of the whole region. And everyone started to speak Aramaic as well, as much in addition to their first language.
So that was another interesting question I had, is because even though it was the lingua franca and people in Judea and the neighboring areas spoke Aramaic, I'm sure they all had their own regional dialects, correct? Like Aramaic spoken in Judea was probably heavily influenced by Hebrew, right?
Yeah, they started to spoke the two languages, and even inside the Hebrew language, we had some dialects. We know that now. And of course, in every region, from Egypt to almost to India, where Aramaic was spoken, everyone created their own dialect. That's exactly the way it works. What we know is that the what we call the Jewish Aramaic, which is the language of the Babylonian and the Palestinian Talmuds, you can see the influence of the Hebrew language. But it's true in the way too. When you read the Mishneh Hebrew, you can see the huge influence of Aramaic language.
And then the modern Hebrew alphabet comes from the Aramaic alphabet, correct?
Yeah. It's what we call in Hebrew, Ktav Ashuri, which is a little strange it's not really Ashuri. Ashuri is Assyrian, and there's a confusion between those two names. That's not that it's another alphabet. It's just the shape, the graphemas, the shape of the letters. Yeah, it was borrowed from the Aramaic.
And then, not to get too off topic, but it's just fascinating to me, so I'm going to go off some different tangents here, but I know there are still some very small communities in Syria that speak Aramaic, correct?
Yeah.
And what do they write in? Do they write in Arabic or do they write in that Aramaic?
That's a good question. I know that until 2012 or 2013, there was a big community speaking Aramaic in the village of Ma'loula, which is, I guess, 70 or 80 kilometers from Damascus. But then they were attacked by the Jabhat al-Nusra. Al-Qaeda, it's not ISIS, it's something else anyway. So I don't know where they are today, if it's still spoken. In lots of regions in Syria, they had a former alphabet like in Palmyre, Tadmor, in Arabic. They had this alphabet very close to the Hebrew alphabet that we have today. But anyway, it's the same alphabet. It's not really important to know what's the shape of the alphabet. It's the 22 same letters from Aleph to Tav, as in Hebrew, as in Phoenician. And all those alphabets come from the same one that we used to call it the Phoenician alphabet. It's not really correct. It's the Northwest Semitic alphabet. We have absolutely no proof that the Phoenicians did invent that. What we know is that the Phoenicians gave it to the Greeks. Right. That's why we call it the Phoenician alphabet. But the Hebrews used that alphabet as well. It's what you can find before the Babylonian era. And you can find the same alphabet in Jordan as well, in the Moabite language, Phoenician, Hebrew, Aramaic, and others.
And how limited are we in what we know, though, of the corpus of those languages? Because I'm assuming we're just looking at texts that remain. Like, do we have a real idea of how people spoke those languages?
You mean the pronunciation?
Right. And the vocabulary. I mean, how much vocabulary is missing?
Of course. I think the worst situation is maybe with Hebrew, because Hebrew is a very famous language because of the Bible. But we think that we lost maybe 50% of the Hebrew vocabulary, because we only have the Bible, almost only. We have few texts, but outside, in addition to the Bible, but it's not much. And about the other, Hebrew is a Canaanite language. Mm-hmm. We have less stuff about the other Canaanite languages, but we have lots of information, really hundreds of thousands of texts in other Semitic languages. The most important sources that we have is for Akkadian languages, but we have much more sources for Ugaritic than we have for Hebrew. So Ugaritic is very close to classical Hebrew, and was when we rediscovered the Ugaritic language in 1928, I think, in Syria. It was very interesting for the biblical studies, because we had much more words than in the Hebrew Bible, and sometimes words that we knew from the Hebrew Bible, but we were not really sure about the meaning, because it's what we call a hapax legomemnon. That means that it's a word that appears only once in a text. So words like that in the Hebrew Bible, we have, I think, 500 words that that appear only once in the text. Right. When we found those same words in the Ugaritic texts, it gave us some more explanations about them. So yeah, anyway, with all those languages, we only have texts. So of course, lots of topics are never... We have absolutely nothing about them. We don't know how was the spoken language, of course. About pronunciation, we know a lot. I think we never can be sure, of course. But we have lots of bilingual texts, for example, with the Greek notations, Persian notations, and other stuff that give us some interesting clues about how it was pronunciated.
I don't know if you can answer this, but how similar would ancient Hebrew sound compared to a modern Hebrew speaker?
It would be very weird to hear that. For example, I don't know if you have a simple sentence just to pronunciate the difference.
Say, I fed my son bread or something.
Natati la yedet sheli lechem. For example, it would be, that wouldn't be so different. Natati la yedet sheli lechem. No, it's not that much. For example, this sentence, this piyut, lecha elite shukati, becha cheshki ve'ahavati. That's a very famous piyut that we hear in Israel and other countries in every Jewish cultures. Lecha elite shukati, which would be in modern Hebrew, it would be lecha elite shugosi, becha cheshki ve'ahavati, becha hashki ve'ahavati. So it's very different. It's right. Maybe closer to Arabic. Sometimes people say that, but it's just very Semitic, very Semitic pronunciation.
Yeah, it sounded really interesting. And we think that's how it sounded based off of these ancient texts that show that, like, you know, if you're looking at a Greek text, it's saying this is how you pronounce this.
It helps us to understand,
right?
Because of course it's another adaptation with the Greek alphabet. Right. So there's some stuff that they can't write down. What is interesting is that we see the vowels, which are not really noted in Hebrew, and we understand that some letters had different pronunciations. For example, the chet letter, which is pronunciated ch in modern Hebrew, we knew that it was pronunciated ha as in Arabic, as in Muhammad in Arabic, but then we understood with the Greek transliterations that sometimes it was pronunciated ha and sometimes ha, just as in Arabic you have the two letters ha and ha. Mm-hmm. As in Khalil or Muhammad, for example. About the Hebrew Ayn, we now know with the Greek transliterations that sometimes it was pronunciated A and sometimes Ra, as in Arabic, Ayn and Rain. So yeah, we could have understand that, but the thing is, we don't know who invented that 22 letters alphabet, and so we understood that the Hebrews just took the alphabet, but had more sounds to pronunciate. So they had to know two different sounds with the same letter. Right. Actually, if you know how to write Arabic, it was the same in Arabic. Ayn and Rain is the same letter. They just added a dot.
Right.
A few centuries after the beginning of this writing. So they had the same problem. They just added those dot before it was too late, before we forgot that we were supposed to pronunciate it different ways.
So there's a pretty noticeable difference in pronunciation of Hebrew from Mizrahi Jews and Ashkenazi Jews. But one thing you hear a lot is, you know, when you hear a Mizrahi Jew speaking Hebrew, a lot of people say, well, that's what it originally sounded like, or that's what it should sound like. Is that a fair statement to make, or is it?
Yeah, that's not really true.
Right. Okay.
Maybe it's more, it's a tough question, because that's not true, considering that anyway, we're very far from what it was. And if the Mizrahi Jews have a pronunciation maybe more connected to the ancient pronunciation, it's not that they kept it better ways. That they come from Arabic-speaking families. So they had those sounds in Arabic. So they pronunciated as they pronunciate Arabic. So actually, it's an Arabic accent. And yeah, that's true. Maybe it comes to be closer, but it's almost a coincidence.
Right.
And actually, we don't really know. So we're not sure about how it was pronunciated. And even when you hear the North African Jews or even the Yemeni Jews, you can hear some pronunciations. Yeah, so the ha, the ayin, the resh, that's true. But maybe that they're really wrong with the vowels. We have no idea.
Right.
We have ideas, but...
And they could have been, and I'm sure they were influenced by a number of different factors as well. So that aren't.
Yeah, right. Sure. They have, for example, I think that the pronunciation, the closest pronunciation from the ancient times is the Yemeni one. But they have an Arabic accent too. For example, they say J for Gimel. J is not the ancient way to pronunciate the Gimel.
Right.
It's just the Arabic way to pronunciate that letter.
Mm-hmm. Unless you're in Egypt.
Yeah, in Egypt they have the G.
Right.
But that's interesting, because that's exactly the same question. It doesn't mean that the Egyptians kept the better pronunciation from before. Right. I think the Egyptian G is an influence from Coptic.
Right.
But something else as well.
And another unfair question to ask you, but with your knowledge of these ancient languages, if you were in a time machine and you were dropped off in in ancient Judea or in ancient Israel or a neighboring country, how much off the bat do you think you would be able to understand, and how quickly do you think you'd be able to pick it up? Or would you be completely lost?
I think I'd be able to understand a good part of it, but I would be very surprised because I'm sure that there's lots of information that we don't have about that pronunciation, about the lexicon and all. The thing is, I learned different Semitic languages, ancient and modern ones, so I think I could pick it up. Like, I could understand it maybe faster than someone else, but I'd be lost, of course, at the beginning.
Right. You never thought about that yourself, or does that cross your mind?
Yeah, of course.
So the topic of what we were supposed to be talking about today was blessings and curses in Judeo-Arabic languages of Maghrebi Jews.
Yeah.
So for people who don't know what Maghrebi is, please explain that.
The Maghrib in Arabic means the West, actually. Maghrebi Jews is North African Jews, actually.
Okay. And what's the history of Jews in North Africa? Does it just go back thousands and thousands of years, or was there a time when...
Usually people think that the Jews in North Africa arrived there at the 15th century after the expulsion of Spain. That's true that some of them are from Spain, and that's why we call them Sephardim, Sephardic Judaism, which is not a good term, actually, because most of them are not from Spain at all. We have informations about how long they have been there. We think it's before Christ, actually. Mm-hmm. The first one arrived there maybe with the Phoenicians. Then another part could be from ancient Libya and Egypt in the second century after of our common era. We know that there was a huge rebellion and that most of the Jews were expelled from that region to actual Algeria and Morocco. Then when the Arabs invaded North Africa, we know from their historians that they met Jewish tribes, Berber Jewish tribes. So we don't know if there were Jews from Judea that became Berbers, like started to speak Berber, or if most of those people were Berbers that converted to Judaism. Right. We have no idea. But what we know, it comes from ancient times and actually in the beginning of the 19th and the 20th century, people, Jews in Morocco spoke Arabic, Berber, and Spanish. So maybe they have different origins.
Right. And before I start asking you about what were the Judeo-Arabic languages or dialects, one thing that I wanted to ask you was, you always hear as a child and even in academia that Hebrew was a dead language until the creation of Israel and then it died out.
Yeah.
Some 3,000 years ago, but is that accurate? Because I was just reading a book on the Bar Kokhba revolt, which was around like 130-ish AD, correct? Yeah. And he instituted, like he made Hebrew the, you know, for whatever territory he had control of, the national language again.
Yeah.
So I have to think that it never went totally dead as a spoken language if they were able to start pick it up so quickly again.
Actually, I have different answers for that. The Bar Kokhba is something very specific because it was a national rebellion. We think that Hebrew was understood. It doesn't mean that they really spoke this language. We're pretty much sure that they spoke Aramaic between them. We don't really know at the whole period, the Mishnah, the redaction of the Mishnah. We don't really know if Hebrew was a spoken language or a language that all the intellectuals still understood. The thing is, then after that, we know that people don't speak Hebrew at all anymore, but they still study it every day. So they know the language. They could try to speak it, I mean, out loud. The real question is, what is dead language? Some people will tell you that the dead language is a language that's not the mother tongue of anyone. That's what was Hebrew. And when it's not the mother tongue of anyone, it doesn't mean that it's really dead, that no one understands it, but it means that it's not a natural thing.
Right.
It gets to be a cultural thing. So
was it like similar to Yiddish in a way? Was it ever spoken in homes or?
No, not really. It was not spoken, but people could try to speak it as if we have, for example, letters from rabbis from North Africa writing to rabbis in Eastern Europe. They used Hebrew. To communicate, but it doesn't mean that when they go back home, they start to speak Hebrew with their wife and children. That's really something else. It doesn't not mean that Hebrew didn't keep on evolving. Yeah, thank you. New words were created, not every day, but were invented by every Jewish thinkers. And so, the Hebrew of the second century of our era, like the period of Bar Kokhba and the Hebrew that was reinvented, something like that, at the Haskalah period in Eastern Europe, is not the same one. It's 15 right. centuries of evolution, but not as a living language.
Right. And was there any attachment to Aramaic amongst you? So in the diaspora, when Jews went from Judea to Rome or anywhere else in the world, did they hold on to Aramaic or did they drop it, use Hebrew as their cultural tongue in writing and then pick up their new language?
They pretty much dropped it. Actually, Hebrew was the sacred language, so which is not the case for Aramaic. Mm-hmm. But some of the texts of the Hebrew of Judaism are written in Aramaic. In Aramaic. Right. Some parts of the Bible, like the book of Daniel, Ezra, and the Talmud is most of the Talmud is in Aramaic. So if you study Judaism, you have to know Aramaic, but mm-hmm. it's not the same as Hebrew, of course. Okay.
All right, so let's go back to the Judeo-Arabic languages of Maghrebi Jews. So what were the Judeo-Arabic languages of the Jews in North Africa?
That's something I'd like to clarify because you can understand different stuff when you say Judeo or Jewish Arabic. Mm-hmm. I'm not going to talk about the language of Jews speaking Arabic in the Middle Ages or of the texts of Maimonides, for example. That is what we call that Jewish Arabic, but it was basically Arabic, written in Arabic in Hebrew letters with the Hebrew alphabet and talking about Jewish stuff. So maybe you can find some Hebrew words on those texts, but it's something else. I'm going to talk about the language of the Jews living in the Arab world in the 19th and 20th century, and especially in Morocco. So in a few words, it's Judeo-Arabic is kind of a generic term which refers to a series of social acts, that's to say the dialect of a social category of a community. Those dialects are Jewish communitary forms of local Arabic dialects. There, for example, in Morocco, in the city of Fes, you have a Judeo-Arabic dialect, which is Fassi Arabic, but the way the Jews speak it in the Jewish neighborhood. In Iraq, in Baghdad, you had a Judeo-Arabic dialect, but it was Baghdadi Arabic, the way the Jews used to speak it. There is not specific understanding between them. When I say Jewish Arabic, it's not the name of language, it's the name of a category.
Right.
It's not different language. It's the language of a different community.
So, but it is Arabic. It's not like it's Hebrew and Arabic mixed together.
No, it's Arabic. The Judeo part of the saying Judeo-Arabic mm-hmm. Means that it's spoken by the Jews. It doesn't mean Hebrew at all. Even if, of course, you can hear some Hebrew words, but not that much.
Okay. And how long did those last for? Do people still speak those or is it just like the elders of the community that still know it?
Yeah, the elders of the community, but it's not connected to the, it's not really related to the language itself. It's related to the history of the Jews of the Arab world. They left basically. Mm-hmm. So they spoke those Jewish Arabic dialects until the end. And today you can hear, for example, for Moroccan Jewish Arabic, you can hear people, in Morocco a little bit, but in France, Canada and in Israel, but not that much.
Right. That's really interesting. And was it purely spoken or was it ever written?
It was written too. And maybe that it was more specific when it was written, because when it was written, it was influenced by the Hebrew tradition. So first it was written with the Hebrew letters. When you read some text, you find much more Hebrew words than when people spoke the language. When they spoke the language, it was basically Arabic. Just as in the United States or in France, when Jews spoke together, they can talk about the bar mitzvah, they can talk about the Brit Milah, but it doesn't mean that they speak a different language. It was a little bit more than that. And in the text, maybe even a little bit more. Some Arab words sometimes have different meanings too, but it's mm-hmm. connected to the context of the speakers. It's not really. Like you have in a city, for example, you have Jewish dialects. Sometimes you have women dialects in the Arabic dialectology. Things are different. It's not the
right.
same.
And do we know that if somebody is speaking a Judeo-Arabic dialect in a specific city in Morocco, they would only speak that amongst their community, correct? Like if they went out of town, they would switch probably to...
Yeah, they could level their language. But in the Judeo-Arabic dialects that I know the best are from northeast Morocco, and the Jews there had a special accent. We don't know where it's from, actually. It's mm-hmm. I think it's just an old way to speak Arabic. But people could recognize that accent, even in other cities, other neighborhoods. They could hear that it was a Jewish accent. And they knew that it was not a different language at all. There was no problem of understanding. It's just that they could hear that.
Can you give an example of a sentence in the Judeo-Arabic accent and then do it in what Moroccan Arabic would be, I guess, whatever you feel more comfortable with, and then tell us what it means?
Yeah, of course. For example, if I say you tell me and I'll go there. Today, you would say, Moroccan Arabic is Gulliya Uradim Shiltuma. With the Jewish accent from Fez, from the it wouldn't be Gulliya but Ulli. Uradinum Sintuma and not Uradinum Shiltuma. So it's just different, like Sheen is pronunciated S, Qaf is not pronunciated.
Right.
Which is, they're very common stuff in Arabic dialectology. So in some places, it's not the Jews that speak that way, but other communities or...
But the not pronouncing the Qaf is a pretty prominent feature of 19 dialects. So is there a reason why they didn't pronounce it and normal Moroccans did, or it's just something that happened?
It's just something that happened. In Arabic dialectology, you're right, the pronunciation of the Qaf is a very specific thing. In lots of cities in the Middle East, people don't pronunciate the Qaf as well. The Palestinians in Jerusalem do not pronunciate it, just as the Jews from Fez. We don't know exactly where it comes from, but it's just maybe because of the particularities of the pronunciation of that letter.
Right.
Yeah.
So to get back to your research on blessings and curses in the Judeo-Arabic languages, what made you want to research that and what's the significance of it to you?
I think, first of all, the curses and the blessing are very common stuff in Arabic language. We play with those sentences, sometimes with the violence of the images that we're summoning when we say that. The interesting thing is that Jews used to have common blessing and curses as just the same as their Muslim neighbors, and some others with connected to the Jewish life, to the Jewish culture, or even with a mix of Arabic and Hebrew on those sentences, especially. Just for example, the name, the blessings, the word blessing in Judeo-Arabic, it's tliba, tlibat. For the Muslims, the same word doesn't mean blessing, but request. To say blessing, they say baraka. So it doesn't mean that they don't understand what a Jew means when he says tliba, but in
so tliba, like to request, like talaba.
Yeah, exactly. It's the older Arab word, which means that, of course, to ask for something, request. In those in the Jewish dialects, if I say tlub, it means that I pray, because it means I ask God something. So tliba is a blessing only for the Jews.
Okay. And when you're talking about curses, are you talking about, you know, like a formal ceremony where I'm going to put a curse on somebody, or is it like street cursing, like Yelana Buk?
Actually, it depends. It could be the two of them. If you want some examples, I can give you for... Sometimes you can hear stuff like Narak bil Itzal, may you meet a murderer. So that's just something bad to say to someone. This one is actually funny, considering that it's obviously ironic. You don't really wish that to someone, but it's quite violent. There's another one that every Moroccan could say. It's when a mother says to her child who doesn't want to eat, which is an everyday situation, the mother can tell him that she wishes that his intestine would be cut into pieces. Tagradim saran. You can say to someone, may you run into a British barrel. So that's pretty weird. Barak bil barud al-inglizi. It can be very, very, very brutal and violent. There's this one that I heard from a woman from northwest Algeria. So it's not exactly the same place, but it's very, very close. Alli ma hadnesh naklo raso nukuf. If someone doesn't like me, I will eat his head. I'll stand in front of his coffin and stay by his side forever. So that's very, very, very bad. And there is, I don't know if you heard that, there's a special pronunciation of the Jews there. For example, they don't pronunciate the qaf, but it's not that they say instead, they say ka instead, which is pretty rare. They say nukuf instead of nukuf. And they say na'ash instead of na'as, so something else. sometimes you can hear Hebrew words in those curses. You can say to someone "itehem zalik," or about someone "itehem zalo." Iteh is Arabic. It means may that fall. Iteh mzalo is his mazal, his luck. May his luck fall. Iteh mzalo. But if you talk to a Muslim, you can say you can replace the mazal with the Arabic word. You can say iteh sa'do, which is basically the same, but with the Arab word.
And were these like widespread enough that if somebody from one Jewish town in Morocco went to another Jewish town in Morocco, he or she could say that curse and they would understand it? Or were they local? So if she said that one crazy one about eating somebody's head, would people look back at her and say like, what?
Actually, the head eating stuff is something that you can hear in Arabic. You say head, just a few sentences in Moroccan Arabic use that expression with the head. People understand that it's not real, that it's an abstraction. You can say there's this very funny one that is not especially Jewish at all. You say to someone, if you want to tell him to mind his own business, "Tchul suq rasik," which means enter the market of your head. Tchul suq rasik. So people are used to it.
Right.
But from one town to another between the Jewish communities, actually they understood they used the same sentences. Not always, but often.
Right. How do you do research on these topics? Like, where do you go for your materials? Do you have to go in country? Do you speak with people who still do know some of those languages? How do you do
it? That's the thing to do. Actually, when I started to work on blessing and curses, I found some articles that people wrote about Moroccan curses, not only Jewish ones. And I found the Jewish ones too. I heard some from people around me, and I asked Moroccan Jews and Moroccans just to tell me more about that. And then I just hear those sentences and try to understand what is said exactly. Do people understand that they use Hebrew words, for example? It's not always the case. For example, there is this this curse, had na'ilabil, which means that punk bearer of bad news, something like that. Mm-hmm. The first word, na'i, comes from classical Arabic. It's na'i in classical Arabic, which is the one informing about the death of someone else. Hmm. And the second word, the Hebrew word, labil, actually is evel. Modern Hebrew, evel, grief, mourning. Actually, the two words are used in a very special way. We could even think that there's a clumsy or awkward understanding of those words because they've never been used like that, nor in Arabic or in Hebrew. And keep in mind that none of those languages were really fluently spoken. People spoke Darija, which is the Moroccan, basically Moroccan Arabic.
Right.
They just knew, they studied classical.
Is that like the spoken, like when you say like Alure Darije, like the spoken language?
Yeah. Exactly. There is another pair that I have in mind, which uses an Arabic word and a Hebrew word afterwards. It's al-haram il-mamzir. I don't know if you understand what that means. Al-harami. Harami
like
is it's an old-fashioned way in Morocco to say bastard. actually, in Darija of today, people would say wul haram, which means son of a sin, of a sinner, something like that. So, that's a bastard. And the second word, mamzir, is modern Hebrew.
That's bastard also in Hebrew, right?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So basically they say bastard twice, al-haram il-mamzir. But the first one is in Arabic and the second one is in Hebrew. They did that a lot.
A lot of the Jews in North Africa came from Spain, like you were saying. Not all of them, but a good amount of them, correct? So
we think it's maybe 20% of them in Morocco.
So maybe it wasn't that big of a percentage that this wouldn't be the case, but do you find ancient Spanish in these dialects?
Yeah, in Judeo-Arabic, you hear Spanish words, but in the classical Moroccan Arabic too. Mm-hmm. But we have some expressions, some sentences like, for example, قد البان قد الكشو. قد is Arabic. It means as much. قد البان, pan is bread in Spanish. And كشو is bread, is cheese in Spanish. So you can hear that. And some Moroccan Jews in the north of Morocco, in the cities of Tanger and Tatouan, Jews used to speak mainly Spanish and Arabic as a second language. In their Spanish language that we call Hakatiya, which is an Arabic word, Hakatiya is Hikaya. Hikaya is story and Hakatiya is small story. In their Spanish language, they used Arabic words like that. I don't know if you're familiar with the Spanish. there's that word in their Spanish dialect. To tell something, you can say audar. Aoud is Arabic. It's the word.
Back, right?
Yeah, it means to go back or to tell a story. So audar is like a Spanish verb with the R at the end of the verb, but aoud is Arabic. So they had the opposite stuff. As we have in Judeo-Arabic with those Spanish words, it's exactly right. The opposite.
And so have you traveled to Morocco to do research, or are you mostly using text and speaking to people who still have knowledge of the language?
I did the two, actually. I traveled, I met people, but basically most of the time I just use texts and speak with the people here in France. Yeah, I find some old books. I work on text mainly.
And there's a huge North African Jewish community in France, correct?
Yeah. It's more than half of the French Jews are from North African countries.
Right.
Yeah.
Do you find, like, whenever you've traveled in country to do your research, does the local community, even though there's not a huge Jewish community there, like, do the locals who aren't Jewish still have knowledge of any of these dialects or expressions, or no?
In Morocco?
Yeah.
Yeah, it happens. It happens, and sometimes people know that it's words from the Jewish dialect. Sometimes they don't know. For example, there's this word, me'ara, that comes from Hebrew. In Hebrew, that means cave. Me'ara, modern Hebrew. So it was pronunciated me'ara in Moroccan Jewish Arabic. And in Moroccan Jewish Arabic, it means cemetery or graveyard. Muslims use it too, but with the specific meaning of Jewish cemetery, as opposed to maqbara. Maqbara is the standard cemetery. So you can hear in a number of common sentences, for example, in the Melah. The Melah is the name of the Jewish neighborhoods in Morocco. You can hear a Jewish lady that could say on the street to a troubled kid, who's not hers, "Narak ummak ta'tak lil mi'ara." May your mother give you to the cemetery. So that word mi'ara has been borrowed first from Hebrew to Jewish Arabic, and then from Jewish Arabic to standard to Darija, to standard Moroccan Arabic. In Hebrew, it means cave, but not cemetery, which gives us informations about all troglodyte practices among North African Jews. By the way, the name of the oldest Jewish establishment in North Africa, maybe from the 3rd century before Christ, is named in Berber Ifran. Berber languages, Ifran or Ufran. Mm-hmm. And Ifran means cave in Berber. So we can think that there's a connection to make between the name of the place, Ifran. It's Ifran at La Sagir, because we have plenty of cities called Ifran in Morocco. Mm-hmm. So it's one in the south. So maybe it's connected to Mi'ara. Regarding etymology, Hebrew Mi'ara is connected to an Arabic word, Maghara, which means the same. It's cave as well.
What's the future of your research on this topic, or have you kind of done everything you can on it?
No, because I'm starting to do something else about those curses and blessings. I heard some of them in Israel, in the modern Hebrew, among North African Jews there, actually, in cities like Ashdod, Beersheba, or Arad, or Dimona, or others. And they use those curses and sometimes Moroccan bad words into their Hebrew language. They say, for example, stuff like, that's really gross.
Go ahead. Fine.
What could I say? There is this insult in Moroccan Arabic with "rohd qawud," which means basically go fuck yourself. And Jews from Moroccan Israeli Moroccan Jews say today in modern Hebrew "lechtit kawed." So that's this very word used in Hebrew. Sometimes they use other stuff, like there's this old Berber verb "agishdor." Agishdor is when the old women during funerals tear their face. If it's so that's agishdor. Then this Berber word was used in Moroccan Arabic, gajdar, which means something else, completely something else. The meaning changed. You can say, for example, in today Moroccan Arabic, eshkadin gajdar tama. What am I gonna do there? What I'm gonna fuck there, something like that. But in Hebrew, in modern Hebrew, you can hear today in Ashdod or Beersheba, "Al titgashder alai," which means please don't be hysterical about that. Al titgashder, and that verb, which the Berber came from Berber, then Moroccan Arabic, then Jewish Moroccan Arabic, and Hebrew, and you can find those words in Hebrew curses of today.
It's really interesting because I've thought about that too, just how it doesn't seem like your research could ever really end because languages are always evolving. And that's one topic that's of extreme interest to me is Hebrew's influence on spoken Arabic inside of Israel.
Yeah.
It might be too early to do real in-depth research on that, but like 200 years from now, it'd be really interesting to look at that.
Yeah, and that's interesting because that's the new connection between Hebrew and Arabic. Before it was among Jews from the Arab countries, and today it's more among the Palestinians in Israel that speak both Hebrew and Arabic. And you can find the same kind of reflexes in what they use and how they play with the languages, with the signification of the words. So that's very interesting. There's someone who works and studies that, which is an Israeli researcher now living in Great Britain, called Uri Choresh. Uri Choresh did lots of works about that.
Yeah, I think I had an Arabic tutor send me his name one time to look into, try to talk to him. I definitely want to try to reach him and talk to him about that. So I know you're doing some research on that topic, but what else do you want to be researching in the future?
I have two very different topics. Mm-hmm. There's the one of the Jewish Arabic inside of Arabic dialectology. I did teach Arabic dialectology too. So I teach and study and Jewish Arabic inside that Arabic dialectology. And I work on all the Semitic languages as well, which is connected but very different. And there I work mainly on the formation of the words in all Semitic languages, in classical Hebrew, classical Arabic, and Aramaic and Ugaritic. Mm-hmm. Those are the four languages that I study, that I will study. And especially on about the pronunciation of the phonemas, morphology, lexical semantics, and...
Right.
So there's a lot of work.
Well, I definitely love listening to your explanations of all this. I mean, I love hearing it presented in this format as a discussion, because I think a lot of times for me, when I'm reading academic papers, even though it's really interesting, you know, 20 minutes in, I can't help it. I'm just passed out. Mm-hmm. You know, when we're talking face to face and I'm hearing, you know, your passion for what your research is in, and also you're able to present it as, you know, in a spoken form, it's really fascinating.
It's something else, really.
So if people want to follow you on Twitter, what's your Twitter handle?
That's a good question. I think it's Jonas Siboni, which is my name. Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's JonasSiboni. Jonas Siboni.
And if people want to find your research, is it on academia.edu or are there any?
Yeah, they'll find me.
Okay, great. Well, I had a great time talking to you. This is really interesting.
Yeah, it was cool.
And
thank you very much.
Yeah, if you ever are doing, you know, research that you want to share and you want to come on again, I'd love to have you on.
Oh, I'd love that.
So hope you have a good rest of the day, and I'll talk to you soon.
Thank you very much. Bye.
Bye.